This is the WTIP Boundary Waters Podcast.
This is the wilderness that Dave and I were both introduced to as kids. You know, our first wilderness camping experiences were in the Boundary Waters.
And in summer, you wake up, you swim through the lake, you have breakfast, then you can relax, you can go paddling, you can go hiking.
We've done this trip before to Horseshoe Lake, and I remember catching walleye there before.
I went on a canoe trip in the Boundary Waters, and it was really cool. It was my first time.
The route from Ram Lake back to Poplar Lake with no packs, with only a day pack, we take it in one day.
Well, you can look to Venus, you can look to Mars. I will set my sights by the northern star and in the deep dark blue. Come the northern lights. Oh, and in the deep dark blue, come the northern lights.
Welcome to episode 10 of the WTIP Boundary Waters Podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Baxley.
And I'm Joe Fredericks.
Today, we are going to be hearing from a couple of epically experienced paddlers. I would even call them elders of our paddling community, Bob O'Hara and Ken Kosick. Between the two of them, they have compiled over 100 years of Boundary Waters travel. Excited to hear their stories today. So let's move on. There is no shortage of things we could say about the gentlemen that we have on the show today. So we're just going to let them say it for us, and let's get to it. So we are here with Bob O'Hara, a personal hero of mine, and we're here to talk about Boundary Waters. But if you know anything about Bob, you know he has a extensive, epic, notorious fame for many different canoe trips. So, Bob, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's good to be back in Grand Marais.
Well, welcome back to Grand Marais as well. Can you tell people who may not know who you are, would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I was a high school teacher, and I taught biology, and I coached, and I was attracted to the Boundary Waters by reading Sig Olson in the 50s, and I came to Ely the first time in 59. I rode the train from Duluth to Ely, and we went out for 15 days, 100 and some miles, and we saw one Canadian Ranger, and that intrigued me, and this is my 60th consecutive year in the Boundary Waters. I'm doing two trips this year, one on the Gunflint side and one on Ely side. In 1967, a friend of ours discovered an out-of-print book by Eric Severide, which has now been reprinted, and it was to go to York Factory, and so we did that in 67, and that's when I discovered further north, and I fell in love with the tundra, and so I've had almost 50 years of Arctic travel and 60-some years of Boundary Water travel, and so the day school got out, I would leave. And I would come back the day school started.
Wow. So being a teacher has its perks when it comes to being
a lot of perks, tremendously. The thing is, the finances weren't the best, so you had to make sacrifices for 9 months to enjoy the 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
But it's well worth it.
That sounds well worth it.
Yeah.
So you took the train to Ely, to Ely, you said?
Ely, from Duluth to Ely.
And did you have any idea that first trip, what you were getting into?
Well, we didn't. We were big campers from the Boy Scouts. We had our own homemade tent. It had no floor and had no mosquito netting. And I didn't sleep on any kind of a pad for at least 10 years or more. We just slept on the ground. We knew a little bit about paddling. I had learned at camp. That's where I saw my first canoe, was at camp. And the reason I fell in love with a canoe is we had a little rowboat. And there's three things wrong with a rowboat compared to canoeing. One, you're facing backwards. Two, you got the 7.5-foot oar. And three, it takes forever to turn and number of strokes. And with a canoe, you're facing forward, you're turning a dime, and you go fast. And I fell in love right there.
Mm. It was instant.
Instant.
Was that on your first Boundary Waters
No,
trip?
That was in 1955 at Many Point Scout Camp.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's really where it all started.
That's where it started, yep.
So when you're describing this different type of canoe camping,
right,
as a young person,
right,
minimal, sounds very minimal.
Absolutely minimal. And all cotton clothing and sailor hats. I got a picture. I found a picture. We looked. So one guy had his letter jacket, and we went to an outfitter. In those days, everything was cans, and we loaded us up with all these cans. Which that's the last time we ever did that because I don't need to carry any more beef stew and all the water in the can. And
right.
We learned in a hurry.
A lot of extra weight.
Yeah, and a lot of extra weight. And we found our way. The interesting thing on that trip was we got to Crooked Lake and all the bays Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and we weren't quite sure where to go. We took the map out and the compass. And on the first round, we had four different opinions. And then we did it again, and then we had two of the four agreed, and we did it again, and three of the four agreed, and the last guy never knew where we were. You know? But we found our way. And then we hit Lac La Croix, and it was pounding waves, and that's the first time I ever figured out what a windbound was. It was pretty obvious it wasn't safe. So we went to shore, threw a tent up, fell asleep. I woke up about 10 o'clock at night. The moon was out. Got the crew up. We paddled all the way through Lac La Croix.
In the dark.
In the dark. You could see silhouettes of what I thought was shore. When I went back 50 years later, it was all islands. I couldn't believe we paddled right down
yes.
the middle of Lac La Croix.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went up Little Indian Sioux. We climbed a fire tower. And when the one guy got on top, he couldn't get down. He was petrified. So we had to blindfold him and then walk his legs down the fire tower.
A little impromptu rescue.
Yes, you just make it up as you go. But it was a wonderful trip. Nobody had a life jacket in those days.
Yeah.
Life jackets were non-existent, you know.
So, you're describing real-time learning.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Where you weren't, like we were just laughing when you came in about the permitting video,
right?
And how you fulfilled your obligation
right.
on your way in because
right.
you're
right.
heading into your own trip
right.
now.
Right.
You didn't have any of that.
There was nothing. There wasn't, and there weren't very many people in 1959. And there were portage signs out in the forest, and there were warnings of waterfalls, which are now not legal because it's a wilderness. But and the maps, I love the maps. They say, you know, for their liability, say not for navigational purposes.
Right.
And, you know, but everything I've ever done is I always take notes of what I would change differently or what I'll never do again. And
this is kind of like a post-trip
right,
reflection
right,
you're describing?
Right. And that's how you keep moving forward. And then the other thing is, before I go on a trip, I always take a walk through the grocery store and see what's new. I don't use the same menu every year because things change. Products that weren't available 40 years ago are now readily available. And you can pack out of the grocery store like nothing, you know?
Yeah.
It works really well.
Yeah. So if, you know, you sort of created this picture of bare bones, camping, you know, barely a tent,
right.
barely a sleeping bag.
Right.
Finding your way in the dark.
Right.
That is your roots in the Boundary Waters.
Exactly. Yep.
And you said, how many years?
This is my 60th year.
So your 60th year. Yep. And you've learned a lot in that time.
I'm still learning in there. Still learning in there.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I've had different canoes. So I had, aluminum canoes. And then later, when I went to Canadian Arctic, I was using 18-foot canoes that weighed 98 pounds, and I used them in the Boundary Waters. And one year, I bought some 20-footers for the Arctic, and I tried them in the Boundary Waters. They're 120 pounds.
Mm.
But the longer the canoe, the faster they go. And now I'm 77, and so now I'm using Kevlar.
Mm-hmm.
I have my original club paddle that I was way too tall and was using my arms way too much, and I now have a 13-ounce bent shaft carbon fiber paddle. So as you get older, you make adjustments so you can keep doing what you love to do. So,
and this is what you love to do.
This is what I love to do, right.
So what does it look like now when you go in? As a contrast to those roots.
I think the biggest difference is, and it's two things. One, the Boundary Water is more popular, which is wonderful because a lot of people are getting exposed. The other thing is that when Quetico changed their fee system, when we used to go to Quetico, you bought a sticker for $2.50, you stuck it on your canoe, it was good for the whole season. Mm-hmm. And now it's $20 a day, and so that's forcing more people into the Boundary Waters economically. And so campsites were really pristine. You could camp on a campsite that maybe hadn't been camped on for a year or two, or maybe only a few people in a season. Campsites are really getting hammered, and so they're really getting worn out, mm-hmm. you know, and that's the one thing you see. On the other hand, it's much cleaner than it ever was because of the leave no trace, no bottles, no cans. And the biggest thing I think that they did is when they put the first toilets were boxes. They were 2x6 boxes and heavy. Now they have the fiberglass toilets so they can move them easily. But people would defecate all over the campsites, mm-hmm. just a little ways out. And now it's all concentrated and it's away from the campsite. And that really, I think, has helped the Boundary Waters.
Mm-hmm. So a few management strategies.
A few management strategies, right. A lot of people don't like rules and regulations, but if it wasn't, it would be a garbage dump.
Right.
And it's really important that we preserve the area. It's a unique area.
So you've personally observed that change.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And the Leave No Trace.
So the Forest Service had a movie because everything that came in tin cans. Before we had aluminum cans and tin cans rust. And the Forest Service had a movie and showed you how to punch a hole in the can, go out to the middle of the lake and sink it. There's a lot of tin cans sunk out in the Boundary Waters. When aluminum cans came, two things happened. One, people didn't take them out and sink them. And two, they just chucked them in the water off the campsite. And it was a mess. And so the no can, no bottle really made an impact on the Boundary Waters.
So that makes a lot more sense where that specific regulation came from.
Absolutely.
It actually has a purpose.
Oh, absolutely.
And a history.
Yes, absolutely.
And I remember when I learned that's how that waste was disposed of.
Right.
I started looking as I would paddle across lakes, see if I could see any mounds of cans. I haven't seen any yet, though, so that's pretty good.
No, they're probably all sunk way down. They probably rusted out by now.
Probably.
Yeah, more than likely.
So you are heading in on a trip right now.
Right, yes.
Tell us what's coming up for you.
Well, I'm going to Camp Minojin first because they send people to the far north, and I try and help them out. I try and meet with their guides and answer questions for them, and I give them a Nunavut flag when they're in Nunavut. And now we have these new maps that are printed on plastic, and you can download them from the internet. So I'm giving them a set for their trip on the Noalai-Kunawak-Kazan to Baker Lake. It's a 529-mile route they're going to do in 40-some days. They got a crew of four or five. And all these camps that go north do a really wonderful job for young people. And then I'm doing something I've never done before, is I'm doing a trip to Newfoundland for 7 weeks to see Canada in the provinces, going to the Canadian Canoe Museum in Peterborough. And I normally carry camping tents and tents that stand high winds like I use in the Arctic, and you're down on your hands and knees to crawl in. And so I went out and bought this 8x8x5 tall car camping tent. It's a marmot four-person halo tent, mm-hmm. and I've never used it. And so I thought, I need to test this out this week and find out what's good, what's bad, and so I don't get surprised. So we're going to do that. And I've never had a chance to walk any of the trails around Duncan Lake, and mm-hmm. so we're going to do that. And then I'm going back to Ely and doing an 8-day solo in the end of August through the first part of September. And I really have enjoyed solo paddling the last 5 years.
Tell us about that.
Well, one, you're on your own. Mm-hmm. You can do your own thing. And solo boats have become very popular now. And I use a double-bladed paddle on the lake. It's so much faster. But kayak paddles are too short for a canoe. They're not long enough. So a couple of companies make long paddles because the canoe is wider, and so you have a bigger reach.
Mm-hmm.
And then I carry a solo paddle or a single paddle if I'm going to do a river. But I remember when the first time I took my solo, I went to Lake One, and there were some retirees from Duluth coming behind me, and they were tandem, and I was solo. And they couldn't catch me with a double-bladed paddle. But when we get to the portage, they went right by me because it takes me two or three trips on a portage.
Right. So it's got its pros and cons in that
Absolutely,
way.
Yeah.
But you found that you can really fly.
Oh, you can fly like crazy. The solo boats are small, they're fast, they're sleek, and they're lightweight.
Mm-hmm.
Some are only 30-some pounds. You know.
Yeah. What are you paddling for your solo trip?
Well, I've got a Bell ABS called a Lone Star, and it does rivers really well. It's got a high bow to it. And I had a Kevlar solo boat, but it didn't fit. It didn't balance for me when I put some weight in. A lot of solo boats are only made for 400 or 500 pounds total.
And you're carrying more than that.
And I'm carrying more than that because I'm over 200 pounds myself.
Right. You're not a small man.
No. I used to be a small man, but not anymore.
Things change.
Time changes. Yes, it does.
What is there something about the solo trip experience that you appreciate?
Well, the solitude is nice, and when you're in a high demand with a lot of people, when I taught, and right now I do 90 athletic events a year for 4 different sports, and some I manage, and some I'm just the head official. But I just finished the section meet. We had 32 teams, and 900 kids, and I hire 70 people, and that's kind of madness for 2 days. And we got lightninged out for the part of the first day, and we had to come back and make things up. To get away from that and go out in nature and just enjoy. And a lot of times I don't travel a lot of miles. I'll just go into all the little bays and coves and all these little creeks that run into a lake. It's a good chance to paddle up until you can't paddle anymore and come back down. And my very first solo trip was many, many years ago. And I went out of Ely on the Cushway River and went into the Gabbro Clearwater area. And I had a brand new textbook. And so I soloed out, and in the morning I did lessons. In the afternoon I would swim and paddle around the lake and explore. And it was such a wonderful experience. It was the best of both worlds. I got my academic work done, sleeping out under the stars, and still had a great time. Speaking of stars, when I used to take students up here, we'd lay out on a Precambrian rock, and the kids would look up, and one kid would say, "How come these stars don't shine in Minneapolis? You know, we have so much light pollution, we don't see stars." So that's one of the advantages of bringing young people north to the Boundary Waters. And you guys have it up here every day, but people in big cities don't have that. And that's what's so spectacular is the night sky.
It's really incredible, isn't it?
And then I remember when the first satellites came up, and you could see these little things zipping across the sky. Now there's a lot of satellites up there.
You know, and I know we're here to talk about you, but I think you can relate to this, and I'd like to know your experience of this. But one of my personal most awe-inspiring memories was paddling Seagull in the Dark.
Oh, sure.
And it was a perfectly calm lake. Yep. And so the night sky just continued in its reflection in the water.
That's really cool.
So surrounding, it was like paddling in an infinite universe.
Right, yep.
And it sounds like you've done some of that.
I've done a lot of that. And I paddled in Quebec one year. It was Northern Lights from sky to sky, and we'd been windbound, and we had to paddle across this lake. In fact, we were laying back in our canoes and just awe-inspired by all these Northern Lights. You almost forgot you're in a canoe. I almost rolled over. And then the other thing was when we hit the other side, we couldn't see, and we're kind of dead reckoning, but we're listening. We're listening for the sound of running water because the rapids coming out of the lake. And two things, we got to find where the outlet is, and two, we don't want to go down the rapids. But your senses are so keen at night when you don't do that during the day. It's just so unreal. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You know, Bob, one thing that sticks out to me that I really appreciate about you is you seem to have a sense of service.
That's true, yeah. That's been my mantra, I think. Maybe also my nemesis, but it's been my mantra. Right?
So how do you see that? Like, because you're in service, I mean, it seems like in a certain way, at least in the topic we're talking about, you're sort of in service to the Boundary Waters and seeing the future generations staying engaged. So what's your approach to that? How'd you find your way into that element of it?
Well, I think it's mostly a share thing, and I'm more interested in sharing with people and giving them ideas and teaching them that there's not a set dogma.
Mm.
And the other thing is, I had a guy come and talk to me about traveling north, and he said, "You're not bragging." I said, "What's to brag about? It's a giant camping trip in the tundra, and as cool as can be." And he goes, "Well, yeah, but nobody does it. I said, so what? You know, I think there's a nature of people who go outdoors who come back and they want to tell people how they conquered the world. And yeah. I would rather come back and say, you need to go out and see this, or you need to go and experience this, because I think that's the way it has to be, you know.
It's a building a relationship with those places versus dominating them.
Exactly, yep.
And I don't know about, so are you seeing, because I know, I feel like that is an older sort of approach.
Well, it is, yeah.
You know.
And I'm an older guy,
yeah. Well, I mean like the sort of like conquering the mountain
right.
approach,
yep.
you know, comes out of sort of these European
right.
roots.
Yep. Right.
And I'm seeing a movement away from that. Are you seeing that?
Yes,
too?
Yeah, I am. The a couple of things I can share with you that I've learned over the years, some little sayings that we have. One is keep the round side down. I tell that to people all the time. And I had a group tip a canoe on me, and they reached way out as far as they could reach to get a glass of water. And I said, what's wrong with the water next to the canoe? And it's the same water. So they roll their canoe. The other is, if you want to rough it, you put sandpaper in the seat of your pants. Because when we go out canoeing, people think you're out in the wilds, that things are impossible. People live that way for eons and eons. It's easy living if you know how, and it's not rough at all.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is that there's no such thing as a free lunch. That's an economic term, but you have to earn everything you want to do. You have to do the portages, you have to do the bugs, you have to do the hot days. And the one that's most important and that runs your entire trip is nature bats last. You do what nature does. And so when it's windy, maybe you can't paddle. And people will come up here on a four-day weekend. They've got to get back to the office. They're on a big lake like Seagull or Sag. And they think that they're going to, if they don't go to the office, it's going to be a catastrophe. And they end up losing their life because they tip over and drown.
Right.
And they don't have things in perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you have to do. So nature bats last. I mean, I sat for my first Arctic trip, I sat in a frozen lake for 10 days because the ice was ungodly thick and we weren't prepared. First trip, we had no lining ropes, didn't know how to walk on the ice. They made me bring a rifle, which was, thank goodness, because we shot three small caribou. We ate caribou for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But I wrote lots of notes, like bring more tea, bring more soup, bring more this. But that's how you learn. And the thing is, so what? I've never missed school. I've come within 8 hours of missing school, but I've never missed school. But if nature says it's not safe to travel, you don't travel.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got this mindset, I'm going to travel because we have this life we live in and doing everything by the clock, then you're not going to make it in the woods because yeah. you're going to get in trouble, you know.
The rules are different.
Rules are very different. Yeah.
Right. And so what's the rest of that? Nature, bats?
Bats, last.
Last.
Last, yep.
Okay.
Nature rules. Another way of saying it, nature rules. And so you respect nature.
So is that something that you feel like came intuitively to you? Or did you have to battle your way into that knowing?
No, I think it came intuitive. Well, on the very first trip when the waves were so big and the canoe was pounding and I'm thinking, this is not safe. We should go to the shore, you know. And then you wake up and it's calm as can be and say, we should paddle. So
yeah.
it's mostly intuitive. Books can only do so much. And if it's not intuitive, then you're probably not doing your trip. You're doing somebody else's trip.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
You got to do your trip.
You got to do your trip.
Yeah, right.
And that is going to look different every time.
It's always different. That's what's so fun about coming back. It's not the same trip.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, so you keep coming back.
Right.
Do you have any favorite? I hate to say favorites, but do you have places that really are dear to you in the Boundary Waters?
Well, I have a lot of places that are dear to me, but they've changed. For example, we had the blowdown that changed Kekakabig. We've had a couple of big fires on the Gunflint that have changed everything. We've had motorboats on some of the lakes now, which is fine, but those motors are not the same. Because there weren't even though there were motors legally there, in the early years there weren't motors.
You weren't seeing them.
No, because it hadn't been established yet, and the resorts hadn't been established yet. So, you know, and then there were, a lot of the routes are circle routes, so you can take a nice big circle, but they've changed over time. So you keep on looking for new. And I still haven't been in all the lakes, and I'm not making an attempt to go to all the lakes.
You've got to be getting pretty close, Bob.
I am, but you know, I tell you, some of these lakes, that you know, it used to be when you were younger, you look for the longest portages because that meant on the other side there's no people.
Right.
But today, at my age, the longest portage is not what I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the exciting portages were the ones where you walk along and you slip off and you're in waist deep muck, you know. You got a canoe on top of your head and you go, "What do I do now?" You know. So.
And then it's an epic just to get out.
Just to get out. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So it's always changing for you.
It's always changing. Yeah.
So I know you've described that the Boundary Waters are changing for you. You're changing in that space.
Absolutely.
And so because you're an elder in my opinion.
Yeah, I am. I basically tell people I'm now part of the geezer generation. You know? I'm not afraid to say that. What the heck, you know?
Yeah. Well, and what comes along with that that I think you embody is that sense of service, that responsibility. You're aware that you are in a position to pass on what you know.
Right.
And the wisdom that you've accumulated.
Right.
So I know you've given talks on this. Speaking to our community, because I consider this our paddling community that right. we get to talk to on this platform, what are the things that you would want to tell them are kind of your top lessons?
Well, first of all, there are three simple letters, food, shelter, clothing, which we do every single day, and everybody in the world does every single day. But when you go out to the wilderness, your food changes, because in the Boundary Waters now you got regulations too. Your clothing definitely changes, but the clothing for me changes constantly. Now I can use this quick-drying nylon. We used to wear wool pants.
Right. You know?
And
or cotton in the very beginning.
Yeah, cotton pants. That's all we own, blue jeans and flannel shirts, you know. And then shelter. And shelter has changed dramatically. And much of it's for the better. But you don't have to be high tech to enjoy the wilderness. And there's lots of things that you can do. So that's one thing. The other thing that's changing, and I don't know if it's good or bad, is when we went in the wilderness, you had this little voice in the back of your mind saying, if you screw up, you're going to die. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's always out there, and it's good because it keeps us honest. And it also makes you hone some skills so that you feel confident that you're not going to die. What's happening now is we have people who have little to no experience. They'll go out with some garbage bags, and they don't have a map and don't know how to read it. But what they have is a satellite phone, or they mm-hmm. have an in-reach or spot, or in some parts of the Boundary Waters, in Ely especially, you can get some cell service. And that is encouraging people to go out and take risks that they're not even aware of, and then that impacts other people to have to go out and bail them out.
Right.
Or they just recently had a drowning over in Ely of a guy who didn't have his life jacket on, which is unfortunate, you know.
So it's a simple thing.
Right. And sometimes on a hot day, they're not comfortable. But on the other hand, you get in that cold water, you can't swim like you normally do.
Right.
You know, that's a problem.
Yeah. So that's the respect of the wilderness
yep.
that you're talking about.
Yep.
That when I feel like when you're paddling along, it's bright and sunshiny and you feel like you're in paradise.
Right.
You can feel very far away from the dangers.
Oh, absolutely. You're not even aware that there might be danger there, right?
Right.
But on a windy day and big waves coming in, and just the fact that a lot of the Boundary Waters doesn't have sand beaches, and to land on a rocky shore and not bust your canoe up or not have something happen to you, you have to kind of understand what's going on.
Yes.
Yep.
I hope that that's a message that is really carried from this. And, you know, the Boundary Waters Canary Wilderness, I think because of its popularity and because of its accessibility, it maybe doesn't carry the same intimidation as, you know, places that you've done
right.
In the far north. But it sounds like you treat both with the same level of respect.
Well, you have to. You know, it's the same. It's a different environment, but it's the same skill set, mm-hmm. and it's the same challenges. And like I say, nature rules. Nature bats last. So whether you get wind in the Arctic or wind on seagull, it's still wind. And you have to respect that.
Yes. I appreciate that. Yeah. And I know we're just about out of time, but I want to hear, even though this Boundary Waters podcast, one, did you ever make it to Baffin Island?
Yes.
You did?
Yep.
Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I didn't canoe to Baffin Island. That was my goal. I ended up flying to Baffin Island to do a heritage river called the Soper River. Mm-hmm. But I had, you know, we all have delusions of grandeur.
Of course.
And back in the 70s, I thought, well, I can just paddle this whole Northwest Passage with a canoe. And I started out from Baker Lake to go up to Chantry Inlet. And then we were going to go on the Boothia Peninsula and then fly out and fly back, make it a 3-year project and just keep moving. And we got stuck in the Arctic Ocean ice that had never been there in August. And that year it was. And had to get a modified rescue to get out. But that was fine, you know.
Are you getting used to that at this point?
Well, you know, you go up north with the intention that if things don't work out, it's my first 30 years in the north, we had no contact.
Right.
And the same thing with the Boundary Waters, we had no contact. So if you're missing, where do people even start to look for you? Right. You know, you don't know. So that's the nice thing about the satellite phone, because before we would either have to get out to a village or we had to get out to where a bush pilot would fly in and pick us up. And two things. One, you're hoping he didn't forget. Two, he's hoping the weather when he gets there is landable. Mm-hmm. And three, you're hoping that he knows where you are and you will get there on time. Mm-hmm. And there's all these what ifs. So, you know, some things you control and some things you can't.
Yeah, a lot of things you can't. It's funny, but one of the things I remembered from that first talk that I heard from you, I believe this was you, is brightly colored gear.
Oh, absolutely.
And so everything buy now. And explain that real quick for me, if you
will. Well, the ethos when the ecology movement started was to blend in the woods and not be seen. And that's true, and for the Boundary Waters, that works. But in the Arctic, when you have someone looking for you or a plane's going to pick you up, you definitely want to be seen. You also want to, we have a few long portages, and people start out with two packs and set one down. A guy did, and we couldn't find it because it was camouflage. And so we had to do a military grid. It took us half a day to find the pack. So I came back, and in 1988, I bought all red packs. I now have red canoes. I got brightly colored tents. I like to wear a red shirt a lot. So when you lay something down, it speaks to you.
Right.
Otherwise, you lose it. You
know? Right.
So it's a matter of practicality. That started out in Colorado when people were camping. They had all these orange tents. And you look out in the mountain, all you see were all these orange tents. And they said it was eye pollution. On the mountains, that's probably true. In the Boundary Waters, you get back in the woods, that's not such the mm-hmm. case. You know?
Well, I've even found that I appreciate when people have bright tents, because then I don't waste time seeing if the campsite's
exactly.
occupied.
you get in the lake and you start looking down the road. Oh, where are we going to go now?
Exactly, yeah. It helps.
Yeah, it does. It does.
So, Bob, I just want to thank you so much for being here. It's an honor to me, and I hope it's an equal honor to all of our listeners to get to hear from you. And I just want to point out, you're on your way to another act of service.
Right.
You're going to Camp Minojin.
Right.
And you do this talk every year.
No, I don't do a talk. I've already met with the guide. I'm bringing them maps. Mm-hmm. I gave them all new maps for their trip. And they're doing a route that they haven't done completely before. It's a route I had done. I've been encouraging them to look at it. And this was the first guide who bid on it. So,
gotcha.
Very excited about that.
Yeah.
They're excited about that too.
So it's a new horizon for a lot of young paddlers.
Exactly. Right.
And that's really what it's all about.
That's exactly. Yep.
Well, best of luck on your trip in.
Thank you.
And I hope we can talk to you again on the podcast sometime.
It would be fun. Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Light come down in a shimmering ray. Oh, for the yearning in my day. Blackened stump bleached by the sun. Oh, for the yearning in my days. Blinding light flash off the sea. God, the northern shore. Each bend and curve beckoned me, shake me to my very core.
Just an excellent conversation there with Bob O'Hara. Matthew, I really appreciate it at the end how, I mean, here we're talking with this experienced, well-known, well-recognized paddler, of course, all over North America, not just, you know, Quetico Boundary Waters scene, and how he tied it in there at the end with the next generation, talking about the next age of paddlers, and how, I mean, you could hear in his voice that was, it's important to him that people continue to enjoy this wilderness, and I thought that was a beautiful sentiment from Bob.
Yeah, I got a tremendous amount of respect for that man and what he values about passing the torch on. And that's a huge responsibility to keep our community alive. And then there's Ken. You know, we've talked all about gear on the podcast, from shoes to stoves, footwear to paddles, and touched on a little bit about one of the most important things taken into the Boundary Waters, which is the boat. And Ken's going to tell us about boats.
And stopping by now to talk making canoes and paddling in the Boundary Waters area is Ken Kosick. He lives in Madison, Wisconsin, and this year completed his 50th consecutive year of making a trip to Quetico Provincial Park. Ken, thanks for stopping by to talk canoeing with us.
Well, first of all, let me say thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. It's quite an honor to be here and participate.
Yeah, no, we're honored to have you here. This is great. I've been looking forward to this conversation. So I want to open with, you know, I mentioned you've done now your 50th consecutive year here in 2018, entering Quetico Park. And you've done more than 50 trips. You've made some multiple years, you know, in years you've made multiple trips and so forth. But I want to start out talking about your class that you've been teaching now for about a dozen years, 12 years at North House Folk School here in Grand Marais. The course is Techniques of Wood Strip Canoe and Kayak Building. And I want to talk about basically building your own canoe. And this, to me, seems like on the surface a little bit of an intimidating concept, building my own canoe. How in the world would I do that? But Ken, it seems like as far as, you know, my background, what I've learned about you and your course, maybe it's not so intimidating. What's your story here with building canoes?
Well, some people are intimidated, and particularly by the glassing process and using the epoxy and that type of thing. But like you say, I've been teaching up here for 12 years, and teach twice a summer, and enjoy the camaraderie and the people that I meet. I tell people, if you can tie your shoes, you can build this canoe. And they look at me and they laugh. And we worked Canoecopia several years with North House, and I'd have a canoe there. And in one particular time, there was five guys that walked up, and I was on one side of the canoe, and they were on the other side of the canoe. And they said, "Wow, we could never build anything like that." And I said, "Guys, if you can, you can tie your shoes, you can build this canoe." "No," I said, "no." He said, "We've all got Velcro and loafers." And I looked over the canoe, and sure enough, they all had Velcro and loafers. And I put my hands up and I said, "I'm sorry, guys, I can't help you guys."
You'll have to rent a Kevlar or something.
Yeah. Hmm. But truly, the steps are very easy, and we've had people that have never had a plane in their hand or a saw in their hand, and they managed to build this nice wood strip canoe, and it's been fun. And it's a family thing. Sometimes there's a husband and wife, sometimes a son and daughter, sometimes a couple of cousins get together. In the class that I teach in September, the earlier class that I teach, it might have eight people who've never met each other, and it's interesting to see the camaraderie and the friendships that develop. And everybody's got a story, and there's some great, great stories out there.
Yeah, and so I think one thing for me, Ken, personally, about building my own canoe, if I was to explore this endeavor or opportunity, would be, how do I get started? I mean, so what type of supplies are you using, and how do you just get the wheels, how do you get out of the gates?
Well, that's a great question. I like to tell people that I don't care if you want to learn how to golf or swim or cook food. It's always good to take a lesson from somebody. And if you're really interested and passionate about whatever it is, go ahead and explore that by taking a class someplace and continuing your education. But primarily the canoes are built with cedars, western red cedar, but you could build it with redwood, you could build it with eastern cedar. So the wood, although it's very beautiful and really sets the canoe off, is a core material for separating two layers of glass. So it's a sandwich construction, and it's very, very strong and very, very light. And you have three layers of a resin impregnated fiberglass cloth on the outside of the boat, and followed by a couple of layers, five layers, six layers of varnish. So you've got a very hard, strong surface. If you do hit a rock or something, it's going to be just fine. It's not going to be the end of the world.
So North House has the materials. If you sign up for this course, the materials are included in maybe a tuition fee or something?
No, they're included in the tuition fee, but I pack my Suburban pretty well full with all my own tools.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many different little steps to this process. So instead of going and running and trying to find a pair of scissors to cut the fiberglass cloth, you're not going to find a pair of scissors in a typical woodworking shop. They're available someplace on campus, but I bring my own hacksaw, I bring my own coping saw, I bring my own saws, hand saws, my own planes. And so I've got those things laid out. I have to bring tape, fiberglass cloth, epoxy, System 3 epoxy. So basically I bring everything, fill the back of that Suburban and put the wood up on top, wrapped up in a nice, tight, waterproof bag, and take the 8-hour drive up here and stop at the Scenic Cafe and another place to get some ice cream nut for on the way. It's not a bad trip to come up.
Yeah, so then the students use these materials that you bring that's included in the tuition course and costs and so forth. And I'm still uncertain about from my vision of how I would go about doing this if I took the course on just the first day or the first few days of how do we actually start to construct and put this puzzle together, if you will.
Okay, so in any endeavor, you have your own language, whether it's golfing, you have the words four and birdie and
par and all this kind of
stuff. Yeah, so in a canoe building business, it's got its own language. You have a strong back. Well, what the heck is a strong back? Well, it's a beam that's straight and level. And so you put templates, which are actually cross sections every 12 inches. If you took a canoe and cut it every 12 inches, you would have a different cross section. And so those cross sections are called templates. And they're aligned on this strong back in the order that you would put them in a canoe. And you have to align those in a perfect straight line, in a perfect plane. And after you get that done, then you can start planking the boat with the cedar. And you staple the cedar onto those templates. Some people are not using staples. They're just doing it without anything like that. But I can't teach a class in 7 days and build a canoe without using staples. So you glue these planks together and the staples hold those planks together until the glue dries. And after you plank the whole boat, you pull all the staples out, and it somehow it all stays together. Well, then you sand it and clean it up and put the fiberglass cloth over the top and wet that out with your epoxy. And so you're going to squeegee off that first layer after maybe half an hour or so of the epoxy setting up. Then you can come back the next day or 4 or 5 hours later for the second coat of epoxy on that. And again, squeegee that off, and then the third layer of epoxy goes on. There's a brushing technique, so you hopefully eliminate all the sags and runs, and you have a nice smooth surface ready to go. So after that outside skin is put on, you can wait a day and take that canoe off those templates and off that strong back and put it in some saddles and start working on the inside. And so you'd clean up the inside and then lay the cloth on the inside and wet that out with the epoxy, and normally you only put 2 applications of epoxy on the inside. Then most people think, well, we've got the canoe done. Well, it's amazing how much time the thwarts take, that put the gunnels in, the deck plates. And so you can spend a lot of time working on those things.
And so you've got I saw sort of what appeared to be like the shell of a kayak while I was down at North House here in September 2018 and witnessed one of these. It was a kayak in this instance being made by a couple from the Twin Cities. And at that point, they needed to somehow, you know, extract or be able to get into the kayak. So let's switch it up just because we primarily talk about canoe travel here in the Boundary Waters on the podcast. So how would you get the shell off and hollow that out? You just extract that and leave the thwart, or do you reinsert wood for a yoke and a thwart, or how does that work?
For a canoe?
For a canoe, yeah.
So you go ahead and pull this off the templates and you build the inside with the glass, and now you've got the core material surrounded by two layers of cloth, and so it becomes very, very strong and stable. But there's still a little give. And in any canoe, you need the thwarts in there to stiffen it up, and you need the gunnels to stiffen it up. So go ahead and put those gunnels on, put the deck plates in, put your thwarts in, your carrying yoke, and seats, and wait a few days for the resin to cure out completely. It takes 11 days for the resin to cure out completely, and then put the varnish on it. Pettit's Captain's 1015 is what we use, and you should wait about 11 days for that resin to cure out completely before you varnish the canoe. And then she's ready to go.
Yeah, so the difference between building a kayak and a canoe is that on the kayak that I saw down at North House was there's not going to be that upper level where you have to cut out an entryway, because you're just building it's already a hollowed out dugout when you're forming the canoe in the first place, as opposed to the kayak.
That's correct. On a kayak, the process is a little different. You have to build it upside down just like you do a canoe, and you do the hull, and you take it off the strong back with the templates still in it, and you put that in the saddles, and the templates are still in the kayak, the hull of the kayak, and you taped that edge of the hull, and then go ahead and plank the deck. And the tape keeps those two from getting glued together. So now you've got you complete the deck of the kayak, and you separate those two. So now you've got the deck in a pair of saddles, and you've got the hull in a pair of saddles. Now you've got to clean out the inside of both of those and fiberglass the inside of the deck and also the hull. And after you do that, now we're going to put them back together again and create the kayak. And before you put them back together again, it's a good idea to cut out the cockpit and build the combing. So you got a way to get that done. Put your foot braces in, put your seat in before you put the two halves together.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, well, absolutely. And so how much of a hands-on process is this for a student who would take this course from you to build a kayak or a canoe? Are you just more an observer and they're actually, you know, getting their hands dirty, for lack of a better way of describing it?
Oh, that's a great question, Joel. There's a fine balance between having somebody watch me build a canoe or a kayak and having them participate in a build. And I try to have the students build as much as possible. And a simple task is pulling out the staples. And while I'm pulling out the staples, they're doing some work on the boat. The delicate work of filling in the football of the kayak or the football of the canoe, which is when you start planking the boat up, all of a sudden you get to the very bottom of the canoe or the very bottom of the hull of the kayak, and you have this opening that's the shape of a football. And so those pieces have to have a triangle on each end, and it has to be exactly the right length. And so while they're doing, I show them how to do that, and while they're doing that, I'm pulling staples. I'm doing some of the cleanup work and keeping an eye on making sure they're doing it the right way. So most of the people that come up here want to build. They want to use their hands. They don't want to watch me build. They want me to teach them how to build, and I'm more than happy to do that. And so far, it's been a great ride.
Yeah, all right. So let's talk about the functionality of these watercraft that are being built through this course and your teachings, because the couple that I just referenced, who are from the cities and were up in September 2018 at North House, building this kayak, they were telling me they're taking that home. I mean, this isn't you build it and then North House hangs it on a wall necessarily, or you take it or sell it or something. They bring that home with them. And so is that's part of the course?
That's the second class that I teach is in September. And that one, like I said, a father, son, husband, wife, whatever, the team comes up and they build a canoe or a kayak, they take it home. It's an expensive class. It's $4,500, so it's not something that everybody can afford. The earlier class that I teach in June is in that nominal $650, $700, and so I have 8 students in that class. And at the end of the canoe build, the canoe is ready to go someplace. And so if you're interested in owning that canoe, with the understanding that you're going to pay for the materials plus 25% to the school, go ahead and write your name on this little piece of cedar and throw it in a hat and see who comes out and wins a canoe. And so that's, somebody's always gone home with the canoe or kayak. It's two different classes that I teach, basically teaching exactly the same thing, but it's a little different situation. You know, people come up to build a canoe, but there's all kinds of other things that happen during the class, and it's camaraderie that people develop and stories that they tell. And there's people there's things going on in their life that you as a teacher don't know about. And they come up here not only to build, but to get away from something and experience something new. And so you as a teacher have no idea of that kind of impact that you have on people's lives. And you may find out later that somebody's wife died. You know, I had a guy and his wife coming up to take the class. And the guy was from the Twin Cities and he had a brother in Florida. And 2 weeks before the class was going to happen, his brother's wife died in Florida. And he said, "I'm coming down to get you. And we're going back up to Minnesota. And we're going to take this class for 11 days. So there's all kinds of other things that happen. And I think the canoe building is one thing. But this other thing that happens is really, really important. And it's... So I'm happy to contribute in that process and get people's minds off of whatever is going on in their lives and I don't know about, but
yeah,
I'm
sure.
Just an enabler in doing that, and that gives me great pleasure.
Yeah, and in some ways, you know, in the less the physical sense of, we don't know exactly the emotions that the Boundary Waters and Quetico feel as an entity, but and many would view it in the same way as you, as the course that people come to escape or get away and start a new chapter, much like they do when they go to Quetico or the Boundary Waters.
Right.
And so, Ken, how about the canoes and kayaks that are being built? I mean, we were getting into that. These often end up on trips going into the Boundary Waters. These are watercraft that are built and they're beautiful, but they're also functional. And have you heard from students who have taken a trip into the Boundary Waters with one of these canoes?
Yeah, we've heard from students that go ahead and take them in. There was a couple of guys that built with us last year, and they were up visiting this week while I was building here, and they took the canoe that we built last September back up into the Boundary Waters and had a good time. And we've taken our own canoes that we've built up into the Quetico in the Boundary Waters, and it's amazing how many times somebody... You know, canoes by that's going in the opposite direction, or maybe somebody that we're passing on the water, you know. We like the canoe fast sometimes. Uh-huh. And but they'll say, you know, it's a beautiful canoe. Did you build it yourself? How much does it weigh? Where are you guys from? And so that's happened so many times over and over over the years. And then so when you're on the Quetico, you may not see somebody for a couple of days. So then one of our guys would, in our canoes, we'd paddle up to each other and we'd kid. We'd say, you know, did you build that canoe?
Sure.
You know, doggone wild, you know, we helped each other build these canoes.
Sure.
So it's been a big joke. And then the other part of it was, where are you guys from? And we would say we're from Madison, Wisconsin, you know. Mm-hmm. And then it would say somebody came up with this craziness about, we thought you were peanut farmers from Georgia. And so this peanut farmers from Georgia thing has been a continuing joke for 20-some years.
Within your core group of paddlers?
Within our core group, yeah. And if I can just deviate a little bit from the canoe building, but there was a time we were coming out of Agnes, and my partner and I canoed past a group of high school guys with a counselor, and we had a nice little visit with them about where you're from and da-da-da and back and forth. And I said, there's a canoe coming right behind us about half a mile down. I said, when they come by, do me a favor, ask them where they're from. And when they say they're from Madison, you say, oh, I thought you were peanut farmers from Georgia.
You set it up, all right.
Set it up, yeah. Of course, when we got to the portage, you know, the canoe said, hey, Ken, you did that, didn't you?
Oh, they were tipped. They didn't immediately fall for it. Yeah, I bet there was an initial reaction.
There was an initial reaction. So I said, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? So with this background, there's four of us camped on Mack Lake up in Aquatico. And I woke up and I thought I heard a helicopter flying over. And so I asked my partner in the tent, Ernie Turk, I said, was I dreaming or did you hear a helicopter too? He said, yeah. He said, I heard a helicopter. I don't know if I was dreaming or not, but yeah, I heard a helicopter. So we both were convinced that we heard a helicopter. And so when my son woke up, I said, did you hear a helicopter? He said, helicopter? I didn't hear no helicopter. You guys are, you know, you've been dreaming. Mm-hmm. So for the next couple of days, you know, we'd wake up in the morning and my son would say, did you hear a helicopter again last night, Dad? I said, no, come on. I'm telling you, it was two nights ago. And, you know, so that was it. So we go down to Wawaeg and we're gone into Kawa Bay and down into Kanipi. And my buddy Joe Bruska and a gang of guys are coming up the other way. And my son had paddled up ahead. They wanted to fish Cannabis Falls for smallmouth. And so I met Joe at this little campsite, and it's kind of neat to meet another group coming the other way. You know, guys that you canoed and fished with, and so little hugs and slaps on the back, and, you know, how are things going back in Madison, et cetera, et cetera. And then Joe says to me, he says, did you hear about that helicopter that was flying over the park? I said, geez, here's somebody that's got, you know, I'm going to verify for my son that I actually heard this helicopter. You know, the joke is over. I can prove to my son, Kenny, that I heard the helicopter. I said, Joe, what was it here for? He said, Ken, they were looking for peanut farmers from Georgia. So those guys.
He tipped him off. This day. Yeah,
they great. Tipped him off. Good. So, oh, you gosh. Know, times like that, really a lot of fun, add to the trip. And so it's
it keeps you coming back for 50 years.
Yeah, I'll tell you, there's stories and animal sightings, and I can go on and on about animal sightings. We've saw a cougar one time up on Mack Lake. Mm-hmm. We've seen moose swimming across. But probably the most interesting one was Arnie Turk and I. That same night that we heard the helicopters, the next morning, this is the truth. I've always said you can almost always hear wildlife before you see wildlife. I mean, that's pretty typical. You can hear an eagle screaming before you see it. It causes you to look up and it's there. Well, that morning it was dead calm. And I hear this clunk, clunk. You know, some rock is hitting another rock. What's going on? And we look down the shoreline and there's a head swimming across the lake. So Arnie and I jumped in the canoe and paddled down there. While we're paddling down, there's a second head. When we get a little closer, there's a third head. So it's a moose followed by a calf followed by a black bear.
No kidding.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing. We got close enough that I could hear that bear breathing. And so I took a picture of the bear, but I had not. I was so excited, I should have got behind and got a picture of all three. I didn't do that, but I did get a nice picture of the bear swimming in the lake. And So that was a pretty exciting.
Yeah. Any conclusion to that? Did anybody make it, you know, well, to shore safely? Everybody.
We, you know, we probably just should have let things happen, but somehow I decided to get in front of the bear and cut the bear off, mm-hmm. and so the bear turned around and went back the other way, and so then we just watched as the moose, the cow and the calf got there. Well. The moose, the calf, the cow got there first, and we're waiting and off to the sideline. And that, for some crazy reason, the calf, there was a big windfall in the lake there. The calf got all confused and turned around and started swimming back across the lake. And this mother moose, you thought she was in this was the Olympics. She charged back into that lake just like, you know, full thrust. Got in front of that calf and got it turned around and back on the shoreline. So that was,
geez, what a morning, what a day!
Yeah, it was a good one.
So 50 years, consecutive years here now in 2018, making at least one trip to the Quetico Park annually. And have you done some BWCA paddling along the way as well?
We've done that. Took a church group up. Was part of that organization that adventure trip. We had an opportunity to go winter camping off the Kekabec. I met a bunch of guys from the Twin Cities, and I got invited to go on this snowshoe trip down to Kekabec and bushwhacked across Binchang and into Jap Lake and built Quincy's. Mm-hmm. Slept in the Quincy's for two nights and then
sure.
back out again. There was a joke about one of the guys said, you know, do you see that snowdrift over there? And I said, yeah, I see it. He said, well, that's where the Quincy was last year, you know. It's like it was the remains of it, you know, just craziness again. But people, you know, just, you kind of, I wouldn't say let your guard down in the Quetico or the Boundary Waters, but you're more relaxed, and it's just people kid each other a little bit. There's a little banter that goes on among the guys and or women or whatever, and that also adds to the trip.
Yeah, so for these 50, you're 77 now, Ken, and for these 50 years, have you always been taking your own canoe that you built, or did you carry a, you know, heavy aluminum along the way in the early days?
The first two trips, I've got a twin brother that taught high school in Milwaukee, and so Eddie decided that he was going to go up into the park, and he invited four high school guys to go. And, of course, I had to convince him that he needed more than, you know, if something happened to him, he should have another adult with him. So Eddie finally said yes. So we went up and rented all of our equipment from Canadian Waters, I think. And so then the second year, he invited six guys. So there were eight of us that went on another trip. And that was all good. And so those first 2 years, we rented equipment. And then after that, we start, you know, building our own canoes and getting our own equipment and borrowing equipment sometimes, Duluth backs. And so it's...
Yeah, and how did you get into... I mean, you're a mechanical engineer?
Civil engineer,
okay.
Retired civil engineer.
Retired, all right. And how did it go? I mean, you weren't a woodworker by trade all your life, you know, as a means of supporting a family and so forth.
No. I got started in scouts, you know, Boy Scouts on the water, and our folks were divorced when we were 5 years old, and there was an uncle that, you know, got us going and fishing, and there were guys at church and the Boy Scouts that, you know, provided that leadership, forever indebted for those guys. And so when I became an adult, I got involved with the Boy Scouts and tried to give back. There's an old saying that you can't help somebody without helping yourself, and you can't hurt somebody without hurting yourself. And I believe that strongly, and I try to live up to that. And I tell people I'm selfish. They say, what do you mean you're selfish? I said, because I know that you can't help somebody without helping yourself. And there's throw your bread upon the water and watch it come back toasting eggs. You know, that's the philosophy, and pay it forward. And
yeah, nice. And now your family is it's a family endeavor to go on trips into Quetico with your children and maybe even grandchildren at that point. Oh, at this point now.
Yeah, we've had many trips where there's been three generations, and one of my grandsons, Spencer, his first trip was when he was 11 months old. So I got pictures of him, and it's all good, I'll tell you.
Yeah, no, that's great, and this has been a pleasure to speak with you and learn more about the craft, the process of building these canoes and kayaks that go into the Boundary Waters. That are built typically here in Grand Marais at North House Folk School. Ken, you're the instructor for this course. If somebody hears this and they were interested in saying either, you know, hey, I want to learn a little bit more about that, or maybe even sign up and take this course from Ken, what's the best means to do so? What should somebody do?
Well, I'll go ahead and contact the school. Either call them up or get on the website. They've got a great website. You know, there's instructors coming from all over the world. It's just amazing. The craft and the skill that these people bring. It's just, I'm humbled by when I'm teaching, I'm walking around, and whether it's going to the blacksmith shop or watching somebody make sausage or do some weaving, and it just, there was a guy here from California this week, Michael Cullen, and they made these little boxes. Well, these little boxes are absolutely phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And the carving that they do and the milk painting that they do. So it's just, it's a great, I say, there's a lake they call Superior, and there's a Superior school called North House. And there's instructors and students coming from all over the world, and it's a great place to come and visit.
All right, fantastic. Well, this has been perhaps the most interesting aspect of the gear element of the podcast here, building your own canoe. I think that's something new for people to think about here as we move forward with the podcast. We've been talking with Ken Kosick. He was a resident of Madison, Wisconsin. He, in 2018, made his 50th consecutive year of going into Quetico, longtime paddler in the Boundary Waters. He also teaches techniques of wood strip canoe and kayak building at North House Folk School right here in Grand Marais. Ken, a true pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, Ken and Bob both, they leave a really beautiful legacy for us to follow.
I mean, like you said at the top of the show, top of the podcast here, Matthew, more than 100 years, consecutive years combined between them, 60 for Bob, 50 now this 2018 for Ken, consecutive years. And the dedication and the, you know, to come back to a place year after year is a remarkable thing. Take time out of your life, your work, your family life, and so forth, to go to a destination such as an outdoor playground. I mean, people go to Yellowstone National Park and
Yosemite National Park.
Some of these much, you know, some of the most visited parks in the world, if not the most. And they'll go maybe once, twice, a half dozen times, unless you live right there at the entry to the park. And that's it. But for the Boundary Waters, what we're finding through the podcast is people come back year after year and they make it a point, and people stay for weeks and months and make it, you know, dedicate their vacation to come back here. And I think that is just an amazing attribute to this wilderness that the podcast is all about.
It's true. And the nature of the people who are coming back year after year that make up our community of paddlers and listeners is one of storytelling, which, you know, is why we exist as a podcast. But that storytelling is what kind of weaves the fabric together, and that's how the torch is passed, through the stories. And, you know, we heard quite a bit recently from the younger generation, and what are they telling? They're telling stories, and Bob's and Ken's stories are the ones that we inherit, and then we pass on ours.
Absolutely, and that's how we started this podcast. Matthew Baxley, here we are, episode 10. We started talking about stories and sharing stories of the Boundary Waters, and we want to hear your stories and share those.
And on that note, we'd like to thank all of you for continuing to listen, and I'd like to thank Joe, as usual.
Hey, Thank you, Matthew. Great episode. Episode 10, we're nearing the one-year mark as we continue forward with the WTIP Boundary Waters podcast.
I just sing when I paddle in, feeling not thinking if the strokes are true. We're gonna get through to the other side. Out in the night, the waves beat the shore. You can hear them pounding, you can hear them roar.